Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this morning is to my right, Justice Bob McCoy. To my left, Justice Bill Meyer. I'm Leanne Dofano. Only one side will be arguing in our first case. And then after that, we will immediately hear our second case. So we have only 1.5 cases set for oral submission this morning, although our docket this morning is quite a bit longer than that. But for oral submission, we have only the 1.5 cases. So if you're ready, I'll ask Deborah to call the case.
Madam Justice Dofano, and may it please the court. With your permission, I will go ahead and argue the points backwards that are presented in the brief, basically from what we consider least settled case law to most settled case law. With that, our third issue presented is whether or not the evidence in the record is what is required to overcome the presumption that is presented by Section 8053 in the Texas Family Code. I think the first thing that needs to be considered is whether or not this presumption is a mandatory presumption or a discretionary presumption. Certain areas of the law, for instance, in certain PJC charges regarding negligence, a presumption is something that may be presumed by a finder of fact or may not be presumed. However, under the language of 8053, it is specifically noted that it is presumed that award of post-divorce maintenance is not warranted unless the following criteria are met. It's our argument that the modifier unless requires that this be a mandatory presumption. Otherwise, the statute has no meaning. Given that it's a mandatory presumption, we then need to look at the criteria that are presented and whether or not those criteria are an exclusive list of criteria or an inclusive list of criteria. For the same reason presented, again, the modifier unless, it must be an exclusive list of criteria or else the statute has no meaning as written. The first of the criteria is whether or not the individual seeking maintenance was diligently seeking suitable employment during the pendency of the separation and the divorce. There really isn't a definition of suitable that's given in 8053. However, case law focuses on the self-supporting ability of the spouse requesting maintenance, as well as the next criteria talking about seeking job skills, again, focuses on seeking job skills to become self-supporting. As such, appellant would argue that any definition of suitable must include that the employment be self-supporting. That given, there is no evidence in the record that the appellee was actually seeking self-supporting employment during the pendency of the separation and the divorce. She
Can't
testified.
Can't you be a missionary and be self-supporting?
You could, but she wasn't looking for a job as a missionary during the pendency of the divorce.
Well, from what I'm able to read, based on your cite to the record, and I'm going to ask you a question about that in a minute, the sum total of her job efforts are, what is it that you want to do? I want to go into the mission field and be a missionary. Okay, have you looked into that? Yes, I have. Roughly how long does the training take? That's different time periods. The one I'm looking at is 16 months. Now, are you aware of anywhere else in the record that discusses her endeavors to obtain training or employment?
I believe that is the only place. I believe on page 51 as well, it asks whether or not she had looked into what continuing education efforts would be required to reestablish certification as a nursing home activity director.
Well, she says, and she I don't want to do that.
But she also said she hasn't checked into it.
All right, so you're representing to us that this is the only place in the record where she discusses her, let's say, diligence in seeking new employment opportunities.
That is correct.
Was there any evidence that while you're training as a missionary, you can't hold down some sort of job?
No, there isn't. I had asked whether or not the course schedule would allow that, and she said that she had not looked into those matters. I think this also bleeds over into the second criteria under 8053, which is specifically whether or not she was diligent in obtaining skills to become self-supporting. She actually developed no skills during the pendency of the divorce or the period of the separation. She says that she looked into a mission training program, but you know, she wasn't able to provide any information about class schedules, about financial aid. And, you know, she freely admitted that she was not seeking employment in the field of mission for any reason other than being called to the position, and that she did not know if she would be able to self-support herself afterwards.
Where in the record are you reading from?
I would be reading from the record at 59 and 60. At the end of it, Apelli testifies that she is willing to take a mission position if the pay is only $8,000 a year, which is, about $1,000 less per month than she was requesting that the court award her in maintenance.
Do you think that what is the burden that she has in proving her entitlement to spousal maintenance? Is it preponderance? Is it clear and convincing, like trying to prove separate property? What is it?
I would believe that it's a preponderance of the evidence, but at the same time, I believe that there is no evidence that has been presented that she would be able to self-support herself in this field. And in fact, she raises a possibility that she very well may not be able to support herself in this field, and that she is not seeking development of these skills for the purpose of self-support.
I think your lead dog is that she really hasn't done enough on the to develop herself to be a missionary, but I think you can support yourself. If you're in the wilds, $8,000, and you is probably a lot of money. I don't know.
I would understand that, but again, there's no evidence of where she would be, you know, missioning.
How old a woman is she? I mean, she's been married, 23 years?
Yes, I believe she's...
Stayed at home and raised her son.
Late 40s, early 50s.
What jobs do you think are available to a woman
that would
actually support her?
Immediately preceding the divorce, she was working at a job that was earning $20 an hour at Alcon, which she voluntarily left because she said there were individuals talking behind her back at work. And, you know, the other thing is, 10 years ago, she was, or 9 years ago, she was also earning $10 an hour at a job at that time.
Was there any evidence about why she was a stay-at-home mom? Was this an agreement that she and her husband reached would be better for their son?
There really was no presented evidence as why that decision was made. I think one of the other issues then, moving on to our issue two, is whether or not the court was able to make a non-arbitrary determination of what the appellee's minimum reasonable needs were. Appellee testified that she currently lives with her parents, and she has testified that there would be a material change in circumstance if she attended mission school. However, she didn't say when this was going to occur, when she expected it to occur, when she wanted it to occur. Furthermore, nowhere in the record does she list what her expected expenses would be, what her current expenses are at home. Generally people present kind of a monthly budget that represents her minimum reasonable needs. There's no number testified to anywhere in the record that quantitatively establishes that. What we do know is that there will be a qualitative change at some point in time that hasn't been determined yet. Because of that, I don't believe that there's a non-arbitrary manner for the court to determine what the appellee's minimum reasonable needs are. And of course, again, in reviewing a trial court for abuse of discretion, the court determines whether the trial court's ruling was arbitrary, unreasonable, or without reference to any guiding rules or legal principles under Kmart v. Honeycutt. Because there's no non-arbitrary method of determining what the minimum reasonable needs are from the uncontroverted testimony, any figure was arbitrary, and it was an abuse of the discretion to assign a figure for the minimum reasonable needs.
So you're suggesting she gets nothing?
I'm suggesting that if the court can't have a non-arbitrary method of determining what the minimum reasonable needs are, it can't, in a non-arbitrary manner, make an award.
So we should remand it for the development of further evidence?
I
or just
don't,
give her nothing?
You know, our argument would be that this hasn't been demonstrated.
So you're telling me give her nothing?
Yes.
Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Okay.
So to speak, Your Honor. However, I don't think that's actually what the evidence has shown here. As I said, immediately prior to the divorce, in fact, the week before the divorce, she was holding down a $20 an hour job, and she testified that she was able to do all of the duties associated with that job, that she voluntarily left the position, and furthermore, that 9 years prior, she was able to work at $10 an hour. Given that she was earning $27 a month, essentially nothing, during the pendency of the divorce, apart from what the appellant was giving her, and she's asking for $1,600 a month post-divorce, we can assume that she can subsist on $1,600 a month. Well, $10 an hour at 40 hours a week is more than $1,600 a month.
Not take home, not even in the ballpark.
You know, but at the same time, if she has a $20, she was able to hold down a $20 an hour job, which there's no evidence in the record that she went out to look for another similar position. Furthermore, she also testified that she would be able to work and save money on her own to send herself through mission training school. And, you know, as such, her uncontroverted testimony is that she would be able to support herself in the current job market and, in fact, defer going to mission training school to a later date when she was able to provide for herself. Finally, we're addressing up front whether it was appropriate for the court to allow a late amended pleading in this case. Under Dunnigan v. Watson, this court followed the analysis in Stevenson versus Kutsarov, which has a five-point analysis to determine whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in allowing a late filed pleading. The first point is how long the suit had been on file. This particular case had been on file for 18 months prior to the final hearing. How soon before trial was the amendment made? In this particular case, the counter petition was made 3 days prior to trial. Did the amendment present a new claim or cause of action? Yes, this was the first affirmative claim ever made against the appellant. And was the new cause of action based on recently discovered matters? I would argue no, that all of this information would have been at all times under the custody, control, and possession of the appellee, and as such was not recently discovered. And finally, did the appellant allege surprise and unpreparedness? The day after the counterpetition was filed, appellant filed a motion to strike the counterpetition, alleging both surprise and arguing in parallel to the allegations in Stevenson that no discovery had been conducted on the issue of maintenance and thus were unprepared to try the issue. As such, given that this is a violation of Rule 63.
Where did you obtain the evidence that we've heard today about maintenance, since you weren't able to do any discovery?
Basically from the record at trial.
Okay, and how were you prejudiced?
Basically by not having...
You knew everything. You knew she worked at Alcon. You knew she quit. You knew that she wanted to be a missionary. You knew that 9 years ago she made $10 an hour. So what is it that you wanted to develop?
We did not know that she had intended to go to mission training school prior to to the trial. That's not present in the record, and that is, you know, although outside the record, in fact. Furthermore, you would have a very different view of settlement prior to trial when you know that the individual actually has a pleading on file that would allow them to ask for this relief. And as such, it may have been that the appellant would not have proceeded to trial if these pleadings were in place and he had a better way of determining what the actual value of the case was. This tremendously changes the value of the case to the appellant 3 days before trial, and, you know, in that sense, does prejudice him.
The only thing, though, you're complaining about is the spousal maintenance.
That is correct.
All right.
If there are no further questions, I will.
No questions, Mr.
Yes.
Davis. I didn't see developed in the briefing any specific reference to dollar amounts in terms of the division of the community property or the property among the spouses. I saw references that the division was roughly equal. I believe the words are similar to that.
Yes.
And what dollar amounts were involved in the roughly equal division in terms of the community property or the property awarded to the wife?
That would have been in the attached decree. I believe that there was a division to the appellee of over $98,000 in retirement funds, as well as one half of the equity of the house that was sold, as well as the division of debts, which is spelled out on pages 9 and 10 of the...
I'm wondering if you can tell me the net equity in terms of cash benefits that she received as a consequence of the division of the property. That would be in addition to the $20,000 spousal compensation award.
I am not sure because it's not clear from the record. The house has been sold. I'm not sure what amount was given to both parties. If I remember correct, that was about $15,000 to each party. There was the $98,000 in cash and retirement accounts, and I believe that each of the parties assumed about $14,000 in community debt.
So roughly $80,000 to $86,000 in cash benefits.
Yes.
Were awarded as a consequence of the division of property in addition to the $20,000 spousal.
That's correct.
Compensation.
But no vehicle to her?
Yes, she had a vehicle as well.
She did have a vehicle. Okay, because I'm looking at the list of his separate property, and it shows a bank account, a pickup, a dirt car and trailer, shop-built trailer, hand tools, cement mixer, welders, air compressor, kayak.
That's actually his separate property that was...
Right, that's what I said.
Okay.
Yeah, his separate property. So I was just wondering if what vehicle was awarded to her.
If she
got an interest in the retirement account, which I guess, although I probably vested, wouldn't be received for some time.
I believe part of it is in, actually all of it was in the form of a 401k. She was given a disproportionate share of the 401k to account for the non-vested retirement benefits.
Okay.
On A4 under W6, it shows that the 2007 Toyota was awarded to her together with all prepaid insurance keys and title.
Okay. So she got... part of the equity of the house, part of the 401k, a Toyota, and the note. Is that right?
Yes.
So she got the Toyota and the note on the Toyota. She got all her debts and liabilities, all the encumbrances, taxes, liens, assessments, or other charges due or to become due on the real property and personal property awarded to her, and then the Chase account, that's debt, charges, liabilities, and other obligations. So okay, I take it that's a debt.
Oh, yes.
Of $28,277.91. And then another debt of $2,180.20. And any and all debt solely in her name. Okay. Any other questions? All right.
Thank you,
Ms. Thank you. Appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted, and you're excused to go about your business. Thank you.